All right, so I'm Rick Hansen, and this is August 22nd, and we're talking here about this piece of material I call Eddies in the Stream. And I'm going to introduce this material, which will include a practice, a guided practice in a moment, by talking about a fairly well-known teaching in Buddhism called the Bahiya Sutta. So Bahiya was a teacher of the Buddha's time who was himself quite far along in practice, who realized that he probably wasn't yet fully enlightened. So he traveled a long distance on foot, as they did then 2,500 years ago, to get the teachings of this person he'd heard about, the so-called Buddha, the one who knows, also called the Happy One, which is interesting, the Buddha known as the Happy One. Anyway, and so Bahiya traveled a great distance to come to see the Buddha. He finally found him. Apparently the Buddha was walking maybe back to his place of meditation after alms round, what have you. Bahiya came to the Buddha and said, "Please, noble sir, may I have your teachings?" And the Buddha replied, "Not now, Bahiya." Bahiya asked a second time, "Please, noble sir, may I have your teachings?" The Buddha replied a second time, "Not now, Bahiya." And then for a third time, Bahiya managed to get his question in. "Please, noble sir, may I have your teachings?" And traditionally, if you get asked three times, you're supposed to respond. So in my own imagination, I don't know if it's true, but in my own imagination, I have a sense of the drama here. And the Buddha's busy, or he's tired, or he's got other things to do, or what have you. Here's this stranger coming up to him who wants his teachings. The Buddha, very awake, very aware, very intelligent, recognizes Bahiya is a very ripe fruit and essentially says, my version of my imagination of the Buddha's mind stream, "You want my teachings? Are you ready for my teachings? Okay, here they come." And threw a fastball right across the center right across the center of the plate. So this is the pith teaching of the Buddha. He says, "Bahiya, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the scene, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. To the sensed, only the sensed. To the cognized, which means thought, felt, wanted, imagined, visualized, and so forth, to the cognized, there will be only the cognized. When for you, there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard and the heard, only the sensed and the sensed, only the cognized and the cognized, then, Bahiya, there's no you in that. There's no self in that. There's no I added. And when there's no I added, when there's no you in that, there's no you there because I is constructed. It's only present when it's constructed. And when there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. There's no existence. This, just this, there's no existence of the ego I. This, just this, is the end of all suffering. In the seen only the seen, and the heard only the heard, the sensed only the sensed, the smelled only the smelled, the tasted only the tasted, in the thought only the thought. That, just that, is the end of all suffering." Bahiya was enlightened on the spot. He was. I think historically, most likely it's true. I wasn't there. There's no videotape at the moment, but it seems likely true. A ripe fruit on the spot. But this is a very fundamental teaching. It's kind of at the core of practice. In other words, let the pleasant be only the pleasant. Let there be only pleasant in the pleasant. Let there be only neutral in the neutral. Let there be only unpleasant in the unpleasant. Not adding craving or second and third and fifth darts and me, myself, and I to that. Letting that just be what it is. Letting there be liking only in the liking or disliking in the disliking without adding wanting to it and selfing along the way. That, just that, is the end of all suffering, which can be perfected to a sublime extent. And yet along the way in this progressive path, we can practice with the Bahiya Sutta. We can hear the Buddha's words. You should train yourself thus, such that in the seen there is only the seen, and so forth. We can train ourselves thus. We can work with this teaching. It's not only reserved for the ripest of all fruits. So in a moment, what I'd like to do with you is a guided practice in which I will, in many cases, just mention sort of briefly as cues some of the major pieces that we've worked with here. And if you can, if it works for you to bring a little bit of deliberateness to opening to or evoking or putting a bit of a log on the fire, if you will, of that particular mental state, great. If it gets too complicated and you just want to let my words wash over you, letting there be sound only in the sound of my voice, or letting there be only meaning in the meaning of the words, that's all fine. Also, if selfing arises, we can apply the Bahia teaching here as well. Letting there be only self in the self in that transient moment, that swirling of that particular eddy in the stream of consciousness, before that too disperses, as all eddies do eventually. All right? So, I'll be quiet for a fair amount of time. I'll feel into it at least 10 minutes or so, where on your own, if you like, you can explore the state of mind of the Bahia state, if you will, the scene in the scene. And I'll also bring in some of the cues that we went through around being versus doing in terms of opening out into really, really spacious, choiceless, open awareness. So there's simply moment-to-moment awareness and its contents. Letting there be only awareness in awareness. And then we'll come back and talk about it a bit and use that as a way into this final bit of teaching. Okay, so that's the plan. Ready? Want to do a practice? So here we go. Coming into a sense of being present here. Simply kind of checking in with yourself, noting what's present, including it in awareness. As they say in Zen, nothing left out. Sensations in the body, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Various emotions, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Thoughts, wishes, memories. In the wandering of the mind, there can be only the wandering of the mind. In the recollection that comes back from wandering, there can be only the recollection without adding self-criticism to it, for example. I'll move the clock, by the way. Another thing to do here, if you like, is to kind of establish a sense of alrightness and even intention in letting yourself be changed, letting change happen, including letting the mind, if it does, without any kind of strain or attachment to it, letting the mind open out to what might be an uncommon state of consciousness. Letting things like that occur, perhaps allowing intensities of joy to happen, or profundities of quiet or spaciousness to happen. Just not seeking those necessarily, certainly not driven about them, but an openness to unusual possibilities in awareness. So to begin with, I'll name some sort of cues or factors First, establish an intention, both top down and bottom up, for this practice. Whatever that might be for you, it could be a wordless intention, a direction, an aiming, along with perhaps a bottom up felt sense of what it would be to arrive there. Or it might be more verbal, there might be a word or a phrase. Establishing an intention, grounding in intention, giving over to an intention or set of intentions here. Throughout this practice, opening to receiving its benefits, whatever those are for you, so that you are taking in the good of the states of mind that have arisen or you've cultivated, so that they sink down into you. In effect, they become installed increasingly in your body-mind. As important resources you can take with you wherever you go. So knowing and from time to time helping yourself really absorb whatever has been useful here for you. Really relaxing, perhaps with several long exhalations, relaxing the tongue, letting tension drain out of you, setting down cares and worries, letting the body relax, finding a posture that is both alert and relaxed. Letting go of any unnecessary anxiety, any needless bracing or guarding. Helping yourself experience a sense of protection. A sense of quiet strength. So that you can truly afford to feel safer and safer. Aware that you are actually all right, right now. Aware of enough oxygen, the heart beating, the body's fine. There may be pain, but fundamentally, you are all right, right now. therefore more and more able to abide as a growing calm. The mind quieting increasingly into a growing tranquility, like the surface of a beautiful mountain pond or lake, perfectly quiet. Easing into and abiding as a growing sense of peace. Aware of and experiencing the richness available in feeling peaceful, so that there's enough stimulation present in the experience of peacefulness to continue to rest your attention in it without needing for restlessness to arise. Peacefulness itself is richly stimulating. Also aware of and opening to other positive emotions besides tranquility, such as a sense of gladness or gratitude. Also, in the mind, present alongside peacefulness can be quite happy feelings, opening to and encouraging some happiness to come in, some sweetness of joy. These positive feelings could be simply a quality of great well-being pervading the mind. And it's also fine to encourage, without strain, but encourage qualities of joy, perhaps even little bursts of bliss or rapture. Inviting in happiness if it comes. And then allowing whatever happiness is present to relax into contentment, a sense of the enoughness of this moment. So there is no need for any grasping, any craving. much as there is no need for any aversion, any pushing away, any craving in that regard, because you are already peaceful. Being mindful of abiding pleasantly in a mind in which increasingly there is little to no craving of any kind. No need for aversion, no need for grasping. Abiding peacefully and contentedly. Opening also to feeling cared about in one way or another. Gentle, more kind of an inviting into awareness. Aspects of feeling seen or liked, appreciated, and in particular loved. Taking some moments here to allow in to awareness a sense of feeling loved. Or at a minimum, a sense of feeling included and connected. Aware also of feeling loving in various flavors. For example, bringing to mind someone you feel compassion for. Opening to compassion, the wish that beings not suffer, filling your mind. As well as warm-heartedness, kindness, caring and love, so that increasingly here and now, peacefully and contentedly, you are abiding as love. being fed. Also being loving and caring yourself. Abiding is caring and warm-heartedness. No need for any kind of heartache. No need for any kind of grasping or resisting related to relationships. Any kind of craving or clinging falling away as love increasingly is your state. And then opening the mind even wider to include love as well as contentedness, happiness, and peace, with a sense of abiding in ordinary mind, ordinary in the sense of home. At home, here and now in this moment, at home in the body, at home among the other people here, at home, at rest, without craving or clinging, in a basic quality of peacefulness, happiness, and love. And then letting any sense of effort or deliberateness related to encouraging a sense of peacefulness, happiness, and love, letting that fall away. So that increasingly there is a sense of abiding as awareness, trusting that the factors of peacefulness, happiness, and love that you've cultivated will persist in the background of awareness and from time to time appear in the foreground, which is fine, so that there is a growing sense of awareness as a vast space with no edges, no bounds. In which contents come and go, and there can be a choiceless, open, just sitting, just present, abiding at peace, such that in the herd, there is only the herd. In the sensed, such as the sensations of breathing, there is only the sensed. In the seen, even the little flickerings behind the eyelids, in the seen, there can be only the seen. In the tasted or smelled, there is only taste or smell. In the thought, there will be only the thought. Letting it come, letting it go. Simply abiding as the stream of awareness and experience co-arising. Letting go of I. If a sense of self arises, there will be only the sense of self in the sense of self, not identifying with the sense of self, not adding to it, letting it swirl as an eddy and then disperse it too. All allowed in the field of awareness, the space, like a vast sky through which flocks of birds come and go. Letting effort fall away, except the minimum necessary to sit upright and remain awake. Not trying to make sense of what's happening in the mind, not trying to do anything with what appears and disappears in awareness, not trying to connect things together, in the now, in this moment, continually letting go. helping yourself stay continuously present. And other than that, nothing to do. No effort needs to be made. Nowhere to go. No one needed to be. Aware and letting go. Not claiming, not owning, not identifying with anything in the mind. Simply being and letting go. Soon we will be coming back. And along the way, in a moment, exploring what it's like to open the eyes and truly let there be only the seen and the seen. So when you're ready, opening the eyes and taking some moments to abide in there being only the seeing in the seeing, only the seen in the seen. Eyes opening. If you're all right with this, eyes opening. And also beginning to move some and seeing what it's like for the sensations of movement to be only the sensations of movement. Or letting there be only the choosing of movement in the choosing, the executive functions of movement. You can also explore letting there be only the conceptualizing in the conceptualizing, the comprehending and the comprehending. For example, you might let your eyes read some of the words on the screen and see what it's like for there to be only understanding in the understanding, only the understood in the understood. If you like, you can stay in a very meditative place as I explore this consideration with you in a moment that I'm about to do. Or if you like, you can also be more engaged conceptually, letting there be only the note-taking in the note-taking, or letting there be only humor in the humor, seeing what that's like. And letting it sink in again and again, what it's like to abide in our home of happiness, love, and peace. Abide in our home of awareness itself, which is never sullied or tainted or harmed by what it contains. At home in connection with others, at home in a path that works for you. At home in some knowing of what it's like to have a state of consciousness of just sitting, just being, nothing added. Not self, no craving. letting the sound sink in. Being mindful of it so you can find your way back here increasingly in the future. So I'd like to do an exploration with you that can be related to quite intellectually. There's a place for right understanding, wise view. And it's often best to let this land as a kind of pointing out instruction, and also perhaps almost like a koan in Zen, to kind of stop the conceptual process and open into an intuition of what's true. So, an eddy, if you've ever been in a river or seen a river, is the formation of a kind of structure temporarily in a very dynamic flow. So the river is streaming, some coalescence occurs, organized or self-organizing, and a swirl, an eddy, appears. We can see those swirls out in nature. Visualize a galaxy. It's a kind of eddy of stars. Visualize a solar system. It's a kind of eddy of planets rotating around a sun. Bring it down to an individual jellyfish or a flock of bees, as a kind of eddy coming together on different time scales. Some eddies last a long time. Other eddies are very, very brief. So we have this phenomenon out there in materiality of eddies coming together, patterns. And then they always eventually disperse because they are inherently impermanent. It is their nature to be impermanent. And it is their nature out there in the world to arise due to causes and complex networks of causes. You could think of a river, the 10,000 causes upstream, the seasons, the tides, the history that has shaped the riverbed, all those causes, snow melt, dams, logs falling, all those causes upstream, boulders appearing, falling into the river, all those causes that condition and determine this particular eddy. The same in the mind, in the realm of immaterial flows of information. We have noise congealing into a signal, a thought coming together, an image, a meaning, a law. The area of a circle is pi r squared. 3 + 3 = 6. Those are all eddies, as it were. And in our personal experience, observing as we have, the emergence, persistence, and then passing away of momentary sights, sounds, thoughts, tastes, touches, wishes, memories, smells, emotions, hopes, joys, sorrows, all those coming together momentarily in consciousness, persisting briefly, typically for only a few seconds, as exactly what they are, and then dispersing. That's the nature of experience. Some eddies last longer than others, some perspectives. Being awake is a kind of eddy for about 16 hours or more. And then we're into a different sort of eddy, sleeping. During sleep, they're different eddies. There's dream sleep, it's about a quarter of the cycle. Then there's other kinds of non-dream sleep. Those two are eddies. So what's the nature of eddies? It's interesting that the eddies of materiality are impermanent. The eddies in mentality, in mind, including conscious experience, they too are impermanent. The eddies in materiality come together due to causes, and the eddies in the mind come together due to causes. They arise dependently, interdependently arising. Also, all that appears, all phenomena in materiality, appear in this instant of now. There's no existence in the past, there is no existence in the future. Existence occurs only in a razor-thin slice of time that is actually vanishingly small, that is now. So too, all eddies of thought, all eddies of sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell appear just now, only in now. That is their nature. Now let's see if we can consider the leading edge of now, the emergent edge of now. As soon as you start to think about it, it's no longer now. So it's more like we just have to kind of imagine it, or again and again try to catch a glimpse of the emergent edge of now. Because as soon as things appear, they're gone, right? Because they're no longer existent. They're in the past. They're no longer now. Things only exist now, which is one of the great mysteries in front of our nose all day long. No scientist understands what now is, even though, remarkably, this temporally, infinitely thin slice, time, temporally, infinitely thin slice of now contains all the causes from the past that are conditioning the present and are flowing into the future. Okay? But let's just imagine that somehow we take the slice of now and we imagine what's just before now emerges and as it comes into being. Quantum particles, in terms of materiality, exist in a state of kind of quivering possibility just before they congeal into actuality. That's quantum physics. So in a state of quantum potentiality, they could be almost anything. And then they congeal into actuality at the leading edge of now. They become an electron, a quark, an atom, okay, at the leading edge of now. So too, thought. Just before a thought becomes a thought, a sound becomes a sound, you can watch it emerge in your mind, right? It has this emergent quality. It kind of comes into being, increasingly coalesces and stabilizes, and then it's known as a sound, or a thought, or a sight. And then it persists for a while and passes away. But just before it comes into being, it's held in potentiality. Because the neural substrates that underlie the coalitions of neurons, of synapses, the eddies, if you will, of coalitions that form to underpin a thought, there has to be excess capacity in the neural substrates of awareness, so that they can represent whatever is needed to be represented at any time. A sound, a sight, an opportunity, a threat. So there's all this excess noise. Technically, in the network of the brain, noisy networks are more able to carry signals. because the way neurons typically carry information is they speed up or slow down their firing rate. If neural networks are at the high end or the low end of their range of firing rate, they can't go either way. They can only go one way. Therefore, they carry less information. Networks that are humming with a lot of noise, they're signaling each other, they're firing, but there's no information being carried. It's just noise. That becomes more available for a signal emerging, an eddy of meaning to appear. All right? So too, in the realm of mind, we have this quivering possibility of noise that's getting ready to carry a signal. You see the parallel? We have quantum potentiality quivering, this foamy potentiality getting ready to congeal into actuality at the edge of now. In the mind, with thought, sensation, desire, sight, sounds, all of it, we have a noise quivering and getting ready to carry a signal, to congeal into signal, to meaning, into mind. We have noise preparing to become mind. Okay? So you see the common nature. This means that just before quantum potentiality congeals into actuality, or just before fertile noise congeals into meaning, it is effectively unconditioned. Materiality and mentality at that point, just before, at the leading edge of now, which is eternally the case, there is potentiality but not yet actuality. There is not yet conditioned. It's effectively unconditioned. In the broadest frame, there are conditions that construct quantum potentiality. In the broadest frame, there are conditions that construct the potentialities of a nervous system. But locally, inside this material universe with all its extraordinariness, or locally in this moment of mind, there is an unconditioned quality to the leading edge of now. It's not yet become something. It's not yet become matter. It's not yet become thought, sight, sound, taste, touch. That's our condition eternally at the leading edge of now. We're aware of actuality, which is conditioned. Once it's existent, it's conditioned. But just prior into the emergence into conditioned actuality, it is eternally unconditioned, as the underlying nature of both materiality and mind. And there can be a kind of opening to an intuition of, and through intellect at first, then growing a kind of sense of wild possibility just prior to congealing into actuality. As eternally the case at the emergent edge of now. As things emerge, they're impermanent, they're moving, they're changing rapidly, right? But the nature of things is not changing. In effect, therefore, the nature of things is still. The unconditioned, the deathless, that which does not change, is itself still. If you will, the ground is still. That which it represents in all its eddies, eddying forms, whether material eddies or mental eddies, those are very dynamic on various time scales, whether it's the time scale of DNA replication or the time scale of a sun. Our sun, by the way, in 3 to 4 billion years will use up all its fuel and slowly grow to become a red giant and swallow slowly but surely Mercury, Venus, and Earth. It probably won't get all the way to Mars, and then it will contract again to become a red dwarf. Even this eddy, the Grand Canyon, the Mona Lisa, all our works, all the cemeteries, Earth itself, Venus and Mercury too, will itself eventually disperse out and be gone. Even the Milky Way galaxy will eventually coalesce with the Andromeda galaxy. They will come together. A couple of billion years or so. Plenty of time to get ready for that. All eddies disperse eventually. So coming back then, to finish up here, two points. Point one is that we live in the conditioned. Our thoughts about the unconditioned live in the condition. The actualized material substrates that that have appeared in now that enable us to have thoughts, those are conditioned. We're stuck with them, in a sense. But always existent, always available, always the case, eternally the case, just prior to the conditioned, is unconditioned potentiality in both materiality and mind. And what's available to us, therefore, is a growing intuition of the unconditioned. And if you think of practice, we increasingly reduce our identifications. We open out our identifications. We increasingly disidentify from various positions. We see them as arising and passing away, but I don't have to believe that thought. We disidentify from various reactions to pleasant or unpleasant. Eventually, we even disidentify from the sense of self that comes and goes in awareness. And increasingly, there can be a kind of identification with the allness of everything in materiality, and then even wider and wilder, in a sense, a kind of identification with the unconditioned that's just prior to the allness of everything. See, that's a progressive process. And what's available to us along the way, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, are sudden awakenings where we have an intuition of the unconditioned. It breaks through. A sense of the deathless. A sense of that which is reliable. The great teachings of the Buddha and others are that which is endlessly changing is an unreliable basis for the ultimate happiness. Because you can't place your faith in it. It's always crumbling away. Any experience, as soon as it appears, starts deconstructing itself and dispersing. Trying to hold on to a pleasant sensation is frustrating and doomed to failure. That holding, that grasping, that clinging, that craving is the prescription for suffering. So too, reacting to what's unpleasant just adds trouble to what's already uncomfortable, if not excruciatingly painful. That too is a prescription for craving, clinging, and suffering, right? So we can't place our faith, we can't build our house on sand. It's always changing. It's foamy and unsubstantial, cannot trust it. Where we can base the fundamental causes of our own happiness and welfare are in that which doesn't change. The nature of things, impermanent, interdependently arising, and manifesting, in a sense, as a modification of that transiently then goes away, the unconditioned. That's the first point, a growing intuition of the deathless. The Buddha speaks to this here. He says, for one who clings, motion exists, change, impermanence. But for one who does not cling, there is no motion. He's describing nirvana, here as best he can. Where no motion is, there is stillness, the stillness of the unconditioned. Where stillness is, there is no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming nor going. There's no changing. Where no coming or going is, there is neither arising nor passing away. We're outside that system. where neither arising nor passing away is, there is neither this world, nor a world beyond, nor a state between. This, verily, is the end of suffering. He's speaking there of that intuition of the deathless, of the unconditioned, of the eternal ground, if you will, that's always just prior to what appears. The second reflection here is to ask oneself if Heisenberg was radically right. Heisenberg, the uncertainty principle, his thesis mathematically was that consciousness is required to establish the existence of a quantum particle. And I think about at this point 70-ish, 80-ish years after Heisenberg came up with that, based on quantum mechanics and the rest of it, very clever experiments are now being done that manipulate electrons or photons in such a way that the observation of two potentialities that are held, that two potentialities cause that electron to be here instead of there, or there instead of here, or even with matched particles that are always opposite each other in some way, the observation that determines the plus sign of this electron here faster than the speed of light determines the minus sign of that particle there. In other words, consciousness in these very clever and quite specific experiments seems to convert quantum or even electron, which is big compared to a quantum particle, let alone a proton, determine the nature, the existence of, the actuality of that particular particle. Well, what if that's radically required throughout the material, throughout the substrate of the entire material universe, at its emergent edge of now, not just here, not just inside the cells of our body, not just in the center of the Earth, not just in the moons around Neptune, not just in the 200 billion galaxies throughout the universe as best we know, not just throughout all the little strange stuff in between the galaxies out there in space, everywhere, eternally, always. What if consciousness is always required in the substrate of material reality for potentiality to become something at all? What's another word for that consciousness? God, the divine. For me, it's utterly plausible that some kind of consciousness is required to be eternally woven into the fabric of material reality for it to congeal into actuality always at the leading edge of now. And that potential consciousness is woven into the material substrates of our own mind, our own mental processing. And so in some fundamental way, we abide coextensive out into that consciousness by one name or another. And my notion is that asking oneself, what the heck could be happening in a brain that goes into nibbana? So working backwards, reverse engineering, it seems as if people are in all traditions around the world who go through an awakening and who seem by everyone's account to be really different or affected, or they're not like typical people, you know? Whether they're shamans or the Buddha, Jesus, in my personal opinion, awakened, others and people alive in the world today, forgive me for moving around a bit, they seem to live in this place, or they have an intuition of it. So working backwards, what could have happened for them to have a profound intuition of the unconditioned? There's a kind of freedom fundamentally in them, a non-identification with conditioned phenomena. And they'll talk about it. The phrase of the Buddha is regarding the unconditioned, in that my mind delights. His conditioned mind is delighting in a memory of or an intuition here and now of some intimation of the unconditioned. Others speak of that in a more theistic frame, in terms of God realization, a kind of Ramana Maharshi or others, a sense of absolute identification with the divine. They use that languaging. But it seems as if they're all kind of talking about the same thing, this place of eternal stillness or unconditioned or fundamental liberation or freedom in which they're no longer bound by the congealed eddies of materiality or mentality. It's as if they've seen into the common nature of both the material world, both physical and biological, and the mental world. So how could that happen? So following the roadmap of the Buddha, there's this classic sequence that you see in the suttas, if you know them, where he enters into and then moves through these four jhanas that constitute right concentration. And in the jhanas, there's great quiet in the mind. The mind is extremely quiet. However quiet the quietest mind in this room was, it's even quieter. So the signals start dropping out, and all that's left is fertile noise. Potentiality, not congealed actuality in the mind. And therefore, only potentiality, not congealed actuality in the patterning physically in the nervous system. So as people progress through the jhanas, these four jhanas, as they're described, and you can see for yourself, the mind's getting quieter and quieter, less and less blissed, less and less energized. Very quickly, if not by the first jhana, certainly by the fourth, you've lost sensory awareness. Sights, sounds drop out, tastes drop out, touches drop out. There's just very subtle awareness. And then you go into the next four jhanas, the so-called formless jhanas, which have names like the base of infinite space. That's the fifth. Then even that is too congealed, and you drop out of that into the base of infinite consciousness, right? And then you drop out of that into the base of nothingness. Can you see how quiet the mind is getting? How much the eddies are dispersing? How little actuality, how little patterning is going on in the noise of the brain? And then you go into the eighth step, the final one, which is the neither perception nor non-perception, whatever that is. And then you come to what's called cessation. The patterning stops. Something happens, and then you're kind of outside the ordinary frame to the indescribable. You're there, except there's no there. It's not even happening, but it's like that for a while. And then eventually you come back. The body comes back. You've got to go to the bathroom. You need to breathe. You need to drink something. There's a disturbance, or there's just an enoughness. And yet you take with you, they take with them. I haven't been there myself. They take with them a profound revelatory transformation at that intimation of the unconditioned in mind, because all the signals drop out, which I believe gives them a radical insight in the unconditioned nature of materiality as well. They have a profound insight into the unconditioned nature of mind, which I think also gives them because mind and matter co-arise, gives them an equally profound, liberating perspective on materiality. They sense, they directly know the unconditioned nature of mind, which gives them an intuition into, if not even direct engagement with, the unconditioned nature of materiality. And then they come back and people bug them to talk about it. What in the world happened? So I just talked through this. Okay? And then they sit here, you know, they come back from this state and they attempt to bring words to it. Actually, I'm going to move to this little quote here. I have a friend, Steve Armstrong. I asked him once, what happens when you go through nirvana? A lot of people have had a cessation. Experience is not the right word, but I'll use that word. It's happened for them. They come back. A few of these people, over time, don't seem to be terribly benefited by it, which suggests that, you know, it really helps to do the gradual cultivation before the sudden awakening so that it can hold it, or after the sudden awakening, be sure to do the cultivation. All right. I believe that Steve has had that quote-unquote experience. So he talked about it with me one time, and that's his quote there. He said essentially that when we come back, I'll read it, he says, well, before nirvana, awakening, and there probably are different flavors of awakening that are culturally shaped. Certainly the accounts of awakening seem to be culturally shaped, but there's only one reality, and there's only one brain. So at the end of the day, you know, I think there's a lot of overlap amongst these various circles of either the experience, in quotes, itself, or the account of it. Okay. He says, before this happens, it's like living in a valley surrounded by tall mountains. And I'll add a few things to what he said to me. You're in the valley, you have an intuition that it's possible. As you said, we all, I think, most people, if not all of us, have some intuition of unconditioned, because it's the nature of things. It's like we're living this in this congealed dream all the time, but we have this intuition of what's always happening just prior to the dream, you know? And there's a lot of sorrow. I think one of the reasons we're upset is we feel we feel displaced, moved out of our true state, and we want to come home to the unconditioned, the stillness, the fertile stillness that's always just prior to the busy noise of each eddy. So we see those mountains up there. We know they're there. We have a sense of them. And then one day, through practice, or in some cases, there are these sudden awakening experiences people have, you're standing atop the tallest peak. You're seeing everything from a completely different perspective. People talk about it, as I've known people in this room who've had experiences like that, or they talk about like so many things that seem to be important or bother them or were confusing just totally fall away. So many efforts, there's no point to them, because you're there. It's almost like, why did I, huh? You know, you're there. But life is down there in the valley. And there may not yet be, perhaps, the gradual cultivation that could support you to stay always utterly there. There seem to be gurus who are utterly always there. Literally, they have to be fed, because they just don't care. Body shmati. All right? So, but eventually you come back down from the mountain to the valley, in most cases. But the seeing, that intimation of the unconditioned, the ultimate undergirding of everything, changes you forever. So as we practice in moving to kind of the ending of this journey we've had with each other, I think takeaways are to allow yourself to open increasingly to intimations of unconditioned that are available to us. For example, the space between thoughts? Is fertile awareness not yet congealing into actuality? John Cage talks about as music as that, as the silence between the notes, for example. Or you might have a sense of possibility always present just before things happen. Whatever. In everyday life, we can practice with intimations of unconditioned. You can use reason, if you like. Try not to get lost in eddies of intellectuality and a thicket of views about it. But you can use reason to take you into a conviction that there must be an unconditioned. And it really helps to do practices in which we gradually condition, in a useful sense, the physical substrate of the mind-brain system so that it can sustain and tolerate a growing quiet, as well as a growing singleness of mind that can then kind of keep the container in place to help us move through the progressive process of quieting that allows us to drop out and empty out into and be lived by the conditioned, the unconditioned, I mean to say. The other thing, just to add, is that love is a very important part of this process. It's easy to think of this sort of path of opening out into unconditioned as somehow very esoteric and pulled out of relationship. And yet, it's interesting that, again, great teachers and other practitioners, saints and sages alike, again and again and again and again and again, emphasize the importance of love as a basis of practice. The Buddha, for example, this is not widely known, it's getting more widely known if you read particular teachings of his. He said that amongst a couple other paths, one of which is mindfulness and insight, that love, fully perfected through compassion and loving kindness, and what comes through love, is a sufficient path to liberation. And liberation means being liberated from the conditioned, because in the conditioned, we're not free. That's what liberation means, stepping out of conditioned or having an intimation of the unconditioned, even as we live as conditioned bodies and minds. Right? Love, love coming through us, love carrying us along, unconditional love. Notice the use of that word again, unconditional love as a path, as a carrier, a vehicle, a carrier wave that can also help us feel replenished and nurtured enough to do the radical work of disidentifying from everything. Love, very, very, very important in practice. So I think if you'll tolerate this, I'd like to end in a formal way, relatively quietly, and then I'll happily stick around for talking if you like. And I appreciate your willingness to let me kind of just hold forth here. So as we end, what better way than abiding as love? Love received, opening here and now, if you like. You know, these are my next to last slide. To a sense of the good-heartedness that's been present here for 2.5 days, the sincere intentions, just kind of knowing them, knowing your own good intentions, good heart, being aware of the good heart of other people in the room, recognizing my good intentions, my good heart, knowing that the good heart and good intentions and compassion, kindness, and love you see in others is also present in you. Otherwise, you would know what it is in them. Bringing it back to oneself, resting happily in the knowing of love and the feeling of love. Love in, love out, inhaling, exhaling. And appreciating also, as a kind of final thought, that whatever merit we've accumulated here through our efforts, whatever benefits to ourselves, you know, whatever work we've done, we've done work here, that those benefits are growing in our own life, in the life of the one that we have the highest duty to, our own self and our future self. Those benefits are rippling forward in time. And those benefits are spreading out to encompass others in this room and then others in your personal life, friends and family. And even benefits rippling out in ways known and unknown, seen and unseen. To paraphrase the Buddha, to the great and the small, the young and the old, omitting none, including the non-human beings, including those in our good wishes, the creatures of the air, the land and the sea. And even if you can hear the carrier wave of Captain Kirk saying, going out where no human has gone before, benefit rippling out perhaps in ways known and unknown to all life, all sentience, all consciousness, way out. Why not? Why dream smaller dreams than we need to? So that, quoting Thomas Merton here at the very end, be still. Listen to the stones of the wall. Be silent. They try to speak your name. Listen to the living walls. Who are you? Who are you? Whose silence are you? And like all eddies, this workshop too has now eventually dispersed. So thank you so much. It's a wrap. We did it. And so for those of you who want to stick around a bit and talk, or at all, including about what we just talked about, you're welcome to do that. And otherwise, we are complete.
Thank you so much. I'm leaving. I won't be able to be at your other workshops, but thank you.